From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. Anyone who has lived by, driven past, or flown over the Great Salt Lake over the past decade can attest that the lake has been receding. Yet even for those who've been watching the waters wane, a report published by Brigham Young University in early 2023 was startling. In that 34-page paper, a team of dozens of researchers and activists warned that excessive water use was destroying the Great Salt Lake. And if nothing changed, the authors predicted the lake would be on track to disappear in the next 5 years. Within months of that report, however, after a veritable snowpocalypse hit most of the state, the lake's seemingly dire fate appeared to have dramatically shifted. The winter of 2023 was record-shattering, with snowpacks exceeding observational records across most of the 27,000-square-mile basin surrounding the lake. As the snow melted, the lake rebounded to a years-long high that left some skeptical of the report, and others publicly contemptuous of it. So, how did the authors of the report get things so wrong? Or were they wrong at all? After all, they never said that the lake would dry up, only that there was a risk that it could happen. On the other hand, if a risk exists, but it's very small, what are the potential consequences of stirring up public concern? Is it akin to crying wolf? Over the next 3 weeks on Undisciplined, we're going to be diving deep into questions like those, telling the story of a lake that didn't die, and a little bit of trust in science that did. I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune and Utah Public Radio reporter Clarissa Casper. She and I have been investigating this question for the past few months for a series in the Tribune called The Seagull and the Snowpocalypse. You can find that online now. Hey, Clarissa.
Hey, Matthew.
And giving us a hand today is Undisciplined producer and frequent guest host Reagan Edelman. Hey, Reagan.
Hi, Matthew. Hi, Clarissa.
Clarissa, tell me about Trish Ackley.
Okay, so Trish Ackley, she's the naturalist at Antelope Island State Park. She's worked there for like over a decade on the island. And she does like education outreach on the island. She works in the visitor center. You've probably met her if you've gone there.
She's been there a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah, so she knows what Antelope Island is supposed to look like. Like, for instance, it's supposed to be an island.
Trish knows what the island looks like. She's watched it over the years as the lake has receded and filled up and receded. She's been there for a while.
Okay. And so recently she's driving along home and she has this experience.
Yeah. She had this special experience with the lake in August where she was driving home on the causeway and she noticed that the water levels were just so high due to the good snow year. And the water was almost reaching the road. She said that water was surrounding her on all sides. And in the water, just birds were everywhere, scattered across the water, almost as if like you couldn't see the water just because there's so many birds. And she just remembers recalling what it was like driving to and from work in 2022. And she was like, wow, I've missed this a lot. Because in 2022, the water, you couldn't even see the water.
It was so far from the road because the lake had receded so much.
Yeah, she described it as she had to squint to see the water.
You know, in 2022, when things were really dire, the water line was shifted so far back. I mean, you might be able to kind of squint and see some life out there on the shoreline, but the shoreline was already so far removed from the causeway. You didn't get that sense that you were in it, right, as you're driving across. So, no, I didn't experience that. It could have been the case if I'd made the one-mile trek by foot to get to the shoreline at that time, but it wasn't, I didn't feel like I was in the middle of it like I did this week.
This is what I'm saying when I say, like, it's supposed to be an island. Like, for a while there, you could walk not just on the causeway to the island, you could have walked on the lake bed to the island.
Yeah, large expanses of the lake bed were exposed.
And for a while, this was a dire situation, no? I remember being told that the entire lake was going to go away. So what happened?
Reagan, in how many years? You remember this, right? Everybody remembers the number of years that people said.
Everybody was telling me 5 years and the Great Salt Lake is gone.
That's actually why we're here today. That's why we're chatting today, because this is what Trish Ackley was experiencing, what we just heard her talk about. That's completely different from the absolutely like haunting picture that a bunch of researchers and activists a few years ago, this was early 2023, they published this report. It's a 34-page paper, and in it they said excessive water use is destroying the Great Salt Lake.
Without a dramatic increase in water flow to the lake in 2023 and 2024, its disappearance could cause immense damage to Utah's public health, environment, and economy.
The lake needs an additional million acre feet per year to reverse its decline.
The lake's drop has accelerated since 2020. If this loss rate continues, the lake as we know it is on track to disappear in 5 years. Okay, so here's the thing. The lake changes its levels every year. It fluctuates. Like back in 1986, which, okay, I know you, like, for you guys was before, well before you were born. I was around. I was little. I was tiny. I was a little Matthew, but I was here. In the summer of 1986, my family was on a cross-country trip. And we came through Utah at a time in which the lake had reached its largest, its highest watermark since observations began way back in the 1850s. So it was huge at one point. And 38 years later, you know, it's waned. It's waned a lot. And as this has happened, there's been people who have, you know, local people who've become more concerned about all of the potential consequences. But when this report came out, it totally touched a nerve.
Now to what some tonight are calling a looming environmental nuclear bomb in Utah. The mighty Great Salt Lake is drying up, and as the majestic lake slowly but surely disappears, there's major concern not only for the wildlife that relies on the lake, but for people living in Salt Lake City and what it might mean for the air there.
It is about the air they breathe. It is about toxic dust. And they're realizing now that if they don't spend billions to put more water into the Great Salt Lake, they could be paying much more forever.
Great Salt Lake, the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere and the eighth largest freestanding lake in the world. But what used to be a boater's paradise and a safe haven for wildlife is now a looming ecological disaster.
One of the natural wonders of the West, Utah's Great Salt Lake is under threat. Officials now sounding the alarm about climate change and the worsening drought, pushing it to the brink of an ecological crisis impacting both wildlife and people.
Tonight, high temperatures and record-breaking western drought has Utah's Great Salt Lake inching toward ecological disaster.
Utah's Great Salt Lake doesn't look so great these days. This place where tourists once bobbed up and down like corks in water far saltier than the ocean is now, quite literally, turning to dust.
I remember that. I had family that wanted to move out of Utah because of talk of all of these harsh chemicals that we were going to be exposed to once the lake dried up. And they were like forecasting what time of year would be best to escape.
Wow.
Before the 5 years were up.
No, this is serious. Like, in the wake of all of this, people were like, I probably should leave.
Yeah, I even had that thought. I was like, is there a future for me here? Should I start looking at other places?
The big draws that Utah had, too, were in danger. I mean, the lake effect is one of the best things for our ski resorts, which is a reason I've known a lot of people to stay. And then mix in the toxic dust and the droughts, I guess. What is there?
And the loss of birds and the changes of weather. And I mean, like, so I was spending a lot of time on Zillow looking out of state. Clarissa, there was something interesting about the timing of when this report came out and when all of these headlines started happening all across the world.
Right. Yeah. It was just weeks before the Utah legislature was to meet for its annual session. Actually, one of the report's authors, Ben Abbott, told me that that is why they put it out when they put it out. They wanted to really make a splash before the session was to begin.
Oh, sure. I mean, we've got a lot more information now than we did then. So I think that there are lots of things big and small that would change in that framing. But we were in a place there. We had to make decisions based off of the best available science. And honestly, we felt a lot of pressure to get this out before the legislative session so that information would be available to our lawmakers, you know, who have a different set of responsibilities than we do as researchers and advocates for the lake.
That was Ben Abbott, a professor of aquatic ecology at Brigham Young University and the lead author of the report.
So Ben said straight up, like, we released this when we did in order to impact public policy. He didn't hide that. That was actually something he was trying to do as a scientist. He was trying to do
it. It was part of their strategy. Yeah.
What is the ethicality behind that as a climate scientist, Matthew? Are there like, is that frowned upon or is that necessary because people today don't always listen to warnings about the climate?
Okay, so there is a really interesting debate that is simmering in the scientific community, and I would say very much at a boil in the climate science community about how much scientists should also be activists. And I think one of the really important things that we should mention about this report, it wasn't just scientists who wrote it. It was a team of scientists and activists, but all the media reported it as scientists. That's the way you guys remember it too, right? Scientists said it was going to be 5 years.
I was convinced that I was going to be getting lead poisoning in 5 years.
Because the scientists had said it,
yes,
right?
Yes, and I trusted the scientists.
But Clarissa, let's talk about the people who were on this report, because it wasn't just scientists who are not perfect, right? Like I'm not like, if it was scientists, it would have been fine. I'm not saying that at all, right? But just for context here, we should know that even though most of the reports said scientists are reporting that this is going to happen in 5 years, this document had like dozens of authors on it.
Right, yeah. And those people, lots of them weren't even scientists. They're just people who work on the lake or do art with the lake or just have a connection to the lake and do work with it.
Ding, ding, ding. Connection is automatically an intense bias that can make keeping a level head a little tricky, right?
Oh, that's a good point. No, it's totally a good point, right? If you're spending time on the lake, if you're Trish Ackley, right? If you're Trish and you are driving down the causeway every day and coming back every day and you're seeing the lake recede and recede and recede and recede and recede, that's got to feel apocalyptic.
And you feel protective of it. It's your home, especially if you're there every single day. You don't want to see that go away. And I imagine, too, even with the extreme changes that were taking place, that a sense of nostalgia probably started in as well that made those changes seem even more drastic and even more dire.
I mean, a lot of these people who were on this report were in their childhood years, their teens, maybe their early 20s, when that lake was at its maximum back in the 1980s, and it was so flush with water. It was so flush with water that the state of Utah spent millions of dollars to pump the water away. That's how much water was in the Great Salt Lake. At one point, this is crazy, right? At one point, we weren't worried about the Great Salt Lake going away. We were like, there's too much water here. What are we going to do?
What a quick turnaround.
Hey, Undisciplined listeners. You might have already noticed that a lot of reporting went into this series. And that's a credit to the really amazing work of Clarissa Casper. Clarissa joined the Salt Lake Tribune earlier this year to report on Northern Utah in partnership with Utah Public Radio. And if you appreciate her work, as I do, there are two ways to show your support.
First, as we always note at the end of this program, you can donate at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Second, you can donate to the Salt Lake Tribune, which was the first legacy news organization in the United States to transition into a nonprofit. To do that, just go to sltrib.com, click on the donate button, and enter code GSL for a discount subscription.
And it's gotten to a point where I almost forgot about that dire 5-year warning. So how much of that was accurate? What was the Great Salt Lake actually looking like?
Okay, well, there are three main sub-basins that flow into the Great Salt Lake. It's the Bear River, the Weber River, and the Jordan River catchments. And one of the things that's important to know here is that all of those catchments have been in a state of low-level drought since the turn of the 21st century. Sometimes it's worse, sometimes it's better. You know, like, it's not like every single year they're in drought. But broadly speaking, for the past now 20-something odd years, those catchments have been in a state of low-level drought, as have most of the United States West. And that's been largely due to gradually diminishing snowpacks in the mountains of northern Utah. We have big years, we have small years, but you average it all out, and the water that comes out is less now than it was 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. But, and this is a really important but, that was a state of low-level drought. You could think of it as like chronic disease. In the past 3 years before this report came out, the severity of that drought had spiked, like, big time. So there's this measure, it's called the 9-month standard precipitation index, and that kind of quantifies wetter and drier conditions against a long-term average. Scientists use this a lot to describe drought. And from the summer of 2020 to the summer of 2021, pretty much the entirety of the Great Salt Lake's watershed was in a severe state of drought. And at one point it peaked with about 80% of that area in a state of exceptional drought. That's the highest classification for drought. There's D1, D2, D3, D4. D4 is exceptional drought. There is no D5. That's as bad as it gets. That's as bad as scientists have been able to imagine it gets.
And did we reach that? Are you saying we were at a D4?
We were at a D4. Like, where you live, where I live, where all of us live, we were in a D4 for a significant amount of time in the years running up to this report.
So it was dire. Just maybe not as dire as we had expected it to be for the sake of the Salt Lake.
Okay, so here is where we have to talk a little bit about how water gets into the lake and also how water comes to the northern Utah mountains. Because the answer to your question, Reagan, is yes, it was dire. And the answer to a lot of other people's questions, which is like, was the report overstated, is also yes, it was totally overstated. It was both of those things at once.
Yeah, they based their much publicized warnings about the Great Salt Lake drying up in 5 years on the state of exceptional drought that Utah was in and the Great Salt Lake watershed was in. In their report, they estimated that the lake had lost about 1.2 million acre feet of water each year, which led to the record low that they cite in their report of 4,188.5 feet above sea level. So basically what the report authors told me is that they follow the trajectory of if we keep losing this much water each year, that 1.2 million acre feet of water each year, how soon is it until we lose all of the water? And they told me that that was 5 years.
There's this hydrologist, Casey Root. He works for the United States Geological Survey. And he had actually done this really cool study that allows us to estimate the volume of the lake based on the elevation of the lake. Because we often talk about the lake in terms of elevation, like 4,188 feet was the record low. That doesn't mean the lake was 4,188 feet deep, right? It means it was 4,188 feet above sea level. The lake's actually only at its real deepest places about 30 feet deep, 25 to 30 feet deep. And so what Casey did is he said, okay, at 4,188 feet, there's this much volume of water. And at 4,189 feet, there's this much volume, and so on and so on and so on. And so 4,188 feet, which is this record low, translated into 5.2 million acre feet of salt water. So 5.2 million acre feet, if we're losing 1.2 million a year, how long do we have?
5 years. Wow.
5 years.
So I talked to Bonnie Baxter about this. She's the co-author of the report and also a professor of biology at Westminster University.
I think I got asked a lot, is it really 5 years? And I think people are still asking about the timeline. And the timeline is interesting because it's actually from that trajectory downward that was extrapolated from the data. You could follow the line, how it was going down, and just continue the line and ask the question, how long before we get here? And that was 5 years.
And when Baxter was struck by this, like, something clicked in her, right? Her and the other authors, they were talking to you about this.
Yeah, right. Like, they all talked to me about how in the years leading up to the lake's record low, they felt the lake's declining levels like an earthquake, like earthquake tremors. That's how they described it. They said that each year the lake went down and down and down. And every year they just had this feeling in them like that something horrible was going to happen. And then seeing this math and seeing that the Great Salt Lake could potentially dry up in 5 years' time, they felt it was their ethical and like moral responsibility to inform the public about this.
The time was just an extrapolation from what we understand, what we're observing on the ground. And it is our responsibility as people who study the lake to tell that to the public. Like, it would not be ethical for us to not disclose that we were seeing that crisis in real time.
So this report gets released on January 4th of 2023. And then that night, this new storm front comes in. And I live in Brighton, Utah. It's at the top of Big Cottonwood Canyon. It started to snow. And it did not stop snowing pretty much that entire month. We got 11 feet of snow that month where I live.
11 feet?
Yeah, but that was just January. And then February came and we got more snow. And then March came and we got more snow. I mean, like, people's roofs were collapsing. There was so much snow.
Yeah, I remember that winter up in Cache Valley was even pretty intense. I remember looking out my window when the snowstorm started and kept rolling in and just being like, I'm not going to leave my house ever again.
Wait, so they were reporting that we had this 5-year timeline that the lake was disappearing. Big reason for that was the lack of snowfall in previous years. And then basically that day, there was this snowpocalypse is what you call it, Matthew, the mother of all snowstorms. And it just blew everyone away. How did we not see that coming? Can't we predict that kind of thing?
We absolutely could have predicted that storm. What no one could have predicted was that it would be followed by another storm, and another after that. And in episode 2 of this series, we're going to talk about why that is, why winters like the snowpocalypse of 2023 are, as far as we can tell at this time, simply the result of chaos. Just tiny perturbations in the atmosphere, like the flap of a seagull's wings, that lead to unpredictable outcomes. And in this way, at the time that the report was released to the public, the one that warned that the Great Salt Lake could disappear in 5 years, there was no way to know that we had just entered into a historic winter. But in our next episode, Clarissa, Reagan, and I will talk about a new way of estimating potential trajectories for the Great Salt Lake that, while not predicting a huge winter, might have offered some clues that the lake was not, in fact, doomed. We have a correction to make. An earlier version of this report misidentified one of the authors. It was Bonnie Baxter, not Linda Freitas, who spoke of the extrapolation of the timeline to arrive at the possibility that the lake could dry up in 5 years. We have corrected that and updated this program. We always correct errors of fact and regret the mistake. Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio, and if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us then, you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University and from listeners like you. You can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. This episode is based on a three-part series, The Seagull and the Snowpocalypse, in the Salt Lake Tribune. The Tribune is a nonprofit news organization that depends on your support, too. You can back its important work at saltlaketribune.fundjournalism.org. The Seagull and the Snowpocalypse is a project of concurrent scientific and journalistic exploration using the research-based reporting framework. That means that I am a co-author of both this series and a peer-reviewed study backing some of this reporting. That study is called A Nuclear Bomb or Just a Joke? Groundwater Models May Help Communicate Nuanced Risks to the Great Salt Lake. And it was published in the journal Water in August of 2024. Our producer is Reagan Edelman. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.